case this morning, Kelly versus Tonda.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Catherine Clark, and I represent the appellants. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Today, we ask this Court to reverse the trial court and restore the case to Mr. Kelly and Dory Don. I think the meat of the matter in this case is the confluence of the 1907 real estate contract and the 1908 deed. The respondents in this case would have you believe that the 1907 agreement is to be read standing alone and that this court should ignore the 1908 deed. That 1908 deed specifically refers to that 1907 agreement not only by date, but by the parties, by the volume and page number, and says specifically on its face that it is done and consistent with the agreements made within the 1907 agreement / real estate contract.
Could I ask you a procedural question?
Certainly.
As I understand it, what you're appealing from an order that granted summary judgment to the Tondas, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, did you also move for summary judgment to achieve the opposite result?
I did not have the opportunity to. We asked for a hearing, which was set for a month later, and given the decision in the court, we didn't get that chance.
I see. So if this case were to be reversed, in your favor, or as you are asking here, are you prepared to try the case? Have you thought out how you would try it?
Yes. I think it's actually...
And what would be the key instructions, do you think?
To a jury?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'd ask for a jury. Not that I'm waiving it at the moment, Your Honor. These are cases that I think I'd come back and either, if favorable here, ask my opponents to say, do we really have to go down this road? Can we resolve it once this court has ruled in my favor?
But let's imagine that you had to go to a jury trial.
Yes.
Always a good thing to imagine.
Well, a rare thing on cases like this. But all right, I will imagine it, yes.
So then how would you instruct the jury?
I believe that I would ask the jury to read all of the documents completely.
No, I'm not asking what you would say in argument. I'm asking about what would be the key instructions that would go into the jury room that the court would give on the law.
The key instruction would be that they must consider the dedicator's intent as evidenced by all the documents that the dedicator allegedly signed and construe those documents as a matter of fact on their intent.
Do you see this then as a Berg versus Huddisman case?
You know, in some ways, possibly. The problem we have there is nobody is alive to testify as to what they thought or did not think at the time in 1907 and 1908. Do I think these documents are ambiguous on their face? No, I do not. I think they are very clear, and they are to be read together. So would additional evidence come in? Possibly. You would have to prove the fact of whether or not that roadway was open and construe whether or not that document constitutes an easement, which is what we believe in 1908 document.
The 1907 agreement envisions an exchange of promises, and presumably there were more documents tendered in fulfillment of that agreement than just the 1908 deed that you've already discussed. Do we have in our record the other documents that were tendered by either party in fulfillment of the 1907 agreement?
No, Your Honor. What we have are the 08 deed and the 07 agreement, both of which have been recorded. No documents were exchanged in discovery on those additional documents.
Did anybody seek to obtain them from the county auditor?
I personally went down to the archives up on First Street and researched the title, specifically myself and the auditor's office, and this is what I found.
Yeah, that's the title to this land, though. But the 1907 agreement references a variety of promises.
Yes.
Each of those promises, if fulfilled, would have resulted in a writing, and presumably that writing would have been recorded because there was other property at issue. That's what I'm asking.
And I agree, Your Honor. I was not able to find that based on my own search of the records.
Okay.
The 1907 agreement does not constitute a dedication standing on its own. We cite to the Ashford versus Reese case from 1925, which the Supreme Court of our state reversed in 1977. This court in the Holmquist case in 2014 reaffirmed the rule in Ashford and acknowledged it and said, basically, any real estate contract that existed prior to 1977 did not vest title or any interest in the property described therein. A deed had to follow. And that's what the 1908 deed does. The language contained in the 1908 deed says, so long as used for a public highway. This court has repeatedly held that that language constitutes an easement. The Holmquist case has similar language, but most particularly the King County versus Squire case specifically said, so long as used for a railroad purposes. And the key language there, future interest from first year law school, so long as, creates an easement. Once the county foreclosed in 1930, that easement extinguished because the county held both the dominant and servient tenement. We would cite to you Radovich versus Newshat on that. Even if you construe this as creating some sort of fee interest, which we don't believe that is the case, it would have reverted because, and reverted at least prior to 1930 or as admitted by the Tondas in 1923, because the roadway was not in use as a public highway. There is no evidence in this case at all from anything that says it was open. And in fact, the evidence before the court shows that King County was relying on the deed and not the contract for the right. That is this plain and simple issue in the case. You will hear there's some argument in the brief that the Nelson versus Pacific County case indicates that the vacation statute applies. We disagree. It's never been applied to documents like that. And we would simply say a deal is a deal in King County and the Tonda should be held to it. That is the end of my opening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have, I think, 3 minutes remaining.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Anbeka Doran. I'm here on behalf of the Tondas. I have with me my partner, Clayton Graham, and also here for the county is John Briggs. The county will be taking a minute of the time, so I will take 9 minutes.
Okay.
This case presented a very simple question to the Superior Court. Did the 1907 agreement contain an unconditional dedication? And the Superior Court correctly held that it does. And there's several reasons for this. The first is the language is unambiguous. And I provided some exhibits to the court that sort of blow up the language.
Two parties engage in a exchange of promises. The following year, one party tenders a deed that purports to be in fulfillment of the promise made to it. That deed contains a limitation on the conveyance. Your position is, on a Rule 56 motion, that creates no inference as to the bilateral intent of the parties to the transaction.
There are a few things I would say in response to that. One is that the court, you asked about Berg versus Hoosman. I think this is related to what you're saying as well. I mean, this court in Seattle, not this court, the Supreme Court in Seattle Times versus Hearst Corporation, if we're talking about contract interpretation, said you can't use extrinsic evidence to vary the terms of the contract, right? So here,
I didn't ask about varying the terms of the contract. I asked about an indication of the bilateral intent of the parties to the 1907 agreement, because what we have in 1908 is one party causes to be drafted a deed and then conveys it to the other party. The other party accepts the deed and then causes it to be recorded. That latter, those two latter actions are odd if the party who accepted the deed and caused it to be recorded was under the impression that had received an unconditional conveyance the year before. So my question then comes back. Your position to prevail has to be that on a Rule 56 motion, the tendering of the 1908 deed with limiting language in the conveyance by one party and the acceptance of that deed and the decision to cause it to be recorded by the other party raises no inferences whatsoever with regard to the bilateral intentions of the parties to the transaction.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the position that we're taking. I agree that it is odd. We don't know why it happened.
And we have to agree with that in order to rule in your favor, right?
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. I would say that first you have to decide what's the proper scope of your review. Can you even look at the 1908 deed in deciding whether what the 1907 dedication was?
Was Berg versus Huddisman rationale presented to the trial court? Court aware of the Berg rule that
I don't think
context evidence always comes in, regardless of whether the contract is ambiguous or not.
I don't know if it was put in that way to the court, but the court was presented, I believe, with the argument.
Because you're now responding to that argument. I mean, you're saying, you can't use the context rule to vary the terms.
Right.
I'm just wondering if that's a new argument.
No, Your Honor.
Presented these to us as because we brought it up, or was it something that you advised the trial court to follow?
These were arguments we made to the trial court. The plaintiff said, it's ambiguous. Look at the 1908 deed, and we said it doesn't matter. The words in the 1907 agreement are unconditional. It would be like me saying I'm going to sell my house one day, and then the next day saying, oh, and I'm going to enter this long-term lease with this other party. You can't give something, and it's settled in the cases, that you can't a year later give something, put a limit on something that you'd already given.
But that was the trial court's ruling, but that presupposes the answer to the question. In other words, rather than viewing all of the indicia of intent, the entire context, what the court appears to have done here is focused only on one thing and then moved on and said, having concluded what the party's intent was, this later document then is a nullity. But that's not the Berg approach. The Berg approach says that you look at the entirety of the circumstances as between the two parties to the transaction.
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't have the transcript in front of me, but I do believe that the court did say, I have to look at everything. I don't think she ruled in our favor on the argument that I'm making to you, that you shouldn't be looking at the 1908 deed. I think she did, and I think she concluded that the 1908 deed is inconsistent with the plain terms of the 1907 agreement.
Well, is that a factual conclusion?
Which, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
That it's inconsistent. Is that a factual conclusion?
No, that's a legal conclusion. That's absolutely a legal conclusion. If the railroad one day says...
Is the intent of the parties a factual question?
Yes, as a general matter, intent is a factual question. I would agree with you there. But I also think that you cannot...
Is the intent of a party that offers a document in conveyance that is limiting in scope, is that a fact?
Yes, it's a fact.
Okay. And is that so it's a fact that gives rise to no inference. That's your position, right?
That's not my position.
So it does give rise to an inference.
Well, I understand. Look, we all understand that 1908 is odd in the sense that it said it purported to put a limitation on something that was great.
Well, it's not odd at all if you view it the other way. If you view it that in 1907 there was a contract that memorialized an exchange of promises, by 1908 the promises had been fulfilled, and therefore that there was a deed tendered, a fulfillment deed, as referenced in the record, tendered. That's normal. What's odd is saying that the agreement that entails primarily an exchange of promises was the end of the matter, and that a year later, each party would engage in what appears on its face to be a normal commercial transaction to no purpose whatsoever. That's what's odd here.
Your Honor, I think to go down that road, you have to ignore the actual terms of the 1907 agreement, which says the railroad does hereby dedicate. It doesn't say will dedicate after some promise is fulfilled. It says does hereby dedicate.
Those words certainly give rise to an inference, don't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
But then the 1908 deed, which has different and limiting language, that also gives rise to an inference, doesn't it?
I don't think it can be used to vary. I mean, again, I come back to the same position, which is, yes, there is.
The question is the intent of the parties.
Yes, Your Honor.
The writing isn't the agreement. The writing isn't the contract. Okay? If this was a reformation of a contract, the rule that would apply is that contracts are not reformed, writings are. So the question is whether the writing in 1907 conveyed the same or different intent as the writing in 1908, and if it's at variance, how does that get resolved on a CR 56 motion?
I think on a CR 56 motion, the court should be looking at the 1908 deed, looking at the language, seeing if it varies the terms of the 1907 agreement, and if it does, it cannot be given effect.
So you're saying that if this were tried to a jury, your position would be that the 1908 deed was inadmissible because irrelevant, or because it had.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think it gives. To answer your question, I don't think it gives rise to it. I don't think it can give rise to an inference.
To concede or cede a minute to the county, now is the time for you to end your argument.
Okay. I will. Let me just say one thing.
All right.
Even if the court concludes that the Superior Court erred by disregarding the 1908 deed, this court can affirm on other grounds, including that Mr. Kelly introduced no evidence that he was a successor in interest to the railroad, and that there was no right of reentry exercise, as there must have been if it was a fee grant.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Briggs, appearing for King County. To be very brief, as you know, the county moved on summary judgment solely on the issue of the doctrine of merger. We were arguing to the trial court that are taking over the properties.
The Tondas are arguing the county's interest in the land.
Yes.
Yeah. So if this were to be reversed and go back, you're saying that the county, who is alleged to have the ownership of the land or the right to use the land, would not be an indispensable party?
No, we would still be an indispensable party, but
you wouldn't be subject to the judgment?
No, I'm not saying that.
I can't understand from your briefing what your position is.
You
brought a motion on a collateral issue. Nobody argues about it. You won. You were dismissed because of the Tondas arguments, and you don't participate for some reason, and it's a mystery to me.
The county made a decision that the issue we were truly interested in was the merger issue. That's why we moved for summary judgment on that issue, and that's why we filed the very brief appellate brief in this case.
So you care not, if there were a remand, you care not what would happen, as long as merger wasn't mentioned.
The merger doctrine was why we were, why we filed our summary judgment.
So even though the county council voted not to vacate this, you don't have an interest in whether or not the county really has an ownership interest?
Well, as we set forth in our brief before the trial court, we don't think that there's ever been intent shown for us to vacate this, because there wasn't a vacation of this right-of-way granted by the county council through the issue
of the statutory process.
Yes.
Can I take one more minute?
Go ahead.
Becker? A reversionary interest has value, right?
Yes.
Okay. Can a statute or ordinance be passed to take away the value of the reversionary interest without the payment of compensation?
I hadn't really been prepared to deal with that idea, but I would imagine that.
Don't we all know? Everyone's sitting here waiting for you to answer, because everybody knows the answer is no. The government can't do that, right? Isn't that the death knell to the ruling that when there's a document of conveyance that's limiting, that has a reversionary interest, that the legislature just can't pass a statute that takes it away without conveying some sort of consideration. I mean, that's why that ruling's wrong, right? It's just that obvious. Nobody thought about it, but it's just that obvious, right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Ms. Clark, I think you have a few minutes remaining.
I do, thank you. And to follow up with Judge Dwyer, Article 1, Section 19 of the Washington Constitution in RCW Chapter 8 addresses eminent domain, and I would agree with the judge that there is a taking should that occur. Coming back, though, to the 1907 document, and there's a paperwork that's been handed to you. Ms. Doran handed that to me prior to oral argument. I've seen it before, but it selectively quotes the 1907 agreement. And if we refer CP 31 to the first paragraph, the party of the first part, King County, grants to the party of the second part the railroad, its successors and assigns, upon the performance of the conditions hereinafter mentioned. And then it goes on with the agreement to dedicate or dedication language, as Ms. Doran would have you agree. Once those conditions occurred, then dedication occurred. Those things could not occur under the state of the law in 1907 and 1908 without a deed, a fulfillment deed. It is that simple. Coming up on Berg and the Berg approach, Ms. Doran is correct. We made these arguments. We didn't characterize them within Berg. But right, I just disagree that the 1908 document is irrelevant. It is, like the 1907 document, a self-authenticating document. A certified copy provided to us by the auditor's office would take care of that. The question would be, what does it say, and what did the parties mean by the express terms of that? Relative to not establishing a successor in interest status to the railroad, again, coming back to the 1930 tax foreclosure, if this court rules that it's an easement, which we believe it should, once the county took possession of both interests, the easement issue and the underlying fee, the easement merged and is destroyed as a matter of law, the maxim being one does not need an easement over one's own property. That was it. Game, set, match. The undisputed facts in this case clearly show that King County referred to the deed. It did not refer to the 1908 agreement, and that it didn't for hundreds of years, or not hundreds of years, at least 100 years, think that it had had anything until this showed up. That 1995 action between Luella Papp and Mr. Johnson is very clear. King County took the time in that document to reserve and preserve its rights to a 100-foot easement, again, part of 07 in the 08 documents, but said nothing about the 40-foot strip here. Thank you. Thank you.